From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR sports program Only a Game. Evan Katz was 45 when he first played the game of baseball. A few years after that, he decided to try a new position.
I wasn't good enough to play the real skill positions in the infield. I wasn't quick enough, so I figured if I could pitch, I might also extend my career.
Katz succeeded in extending his career, but could he extend it all the way to the pros? That's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, another scandal for basketball coach Rick Pitino. Should we be surprised? Not a chance. Stay tuned. When he was about 5 years shy of qualifying for Medicare, Evan Katz decided he'd like to play professional baseball. He'd gotten a late start on the dream. He didn't play as a kid.
No, I didn't play. The family legend, which I think is true, is that Hebrew school conflicted with Little League practice.
Scheduling wasn't the only thing that kept Evan off the diamond.
When I was going to elementary school, I was younger than all my peers, so...
You were the little kid.
Yep, the slowest kid, the littlest kid. Never liked playing tag on the playground.
But though he didn't play the game, Evan Katz loved watching baseball, and when he was 45 years old, having helped two of his kids navigate Little League, Evan found the opportunity to give it a try. A friend who was playing in an over-30 baseball league with an anybody-can-play policy invited him to join the team. And he learned something right away.
It's a lot harder than it looks on TV.
But Katz was not discouraged, even when they told him what position he'd be playing.
It was right field.
Where, as everybody knows, you always put the kid you want to hide.
And as time went on, I moved to left. And after a couple of years, I decided I wanted to try to pitch. I wasn't good enough to play the real skill positions in the infield, and I wasn't quick enough. So I figured if I could pitch, I might also extend my career.
That was in 2005. Katz was nearly 50, and the plan to extend his career got off to a rough start.
My mechanics as a pitcher weren't that good.
That's astonishing to me, given that you didn't start playing till you were 45.
And I decided I need to do something a little bit different to just make it harder for the hitters. And what I decided to do was teach myself how to pitch sidearm.
Katz found a website called Sidearm Nation. Eventually, that would prove to be important to his baseball career, but at first it was just a source of information. And the information, combined with a lot of lonely days throwing baseballs to a backstop, built Evan Katz into a pitcher of some renown, at least in the over-30 league and at the adult baseball camps he attended each winter in Florida, where they grow such things as grapefruit, oranges, and delusions.
And it was about a year and a half ago at the baseball camp in Florida, we had a bunch of rainouts. And I was driving around one day and I said, boy, what if I could find some minor league team that would let me play professional baseball for a day, just so I could say I play professional baseball. And then that's where the germ of the idea formed.
Evan Katz knew he wasn't going to make the roster of a minor league outfit affiliated with a major league team. Even at the rookie league level, that's serious business. So he started contacting teams in the independent leagues, the teams stocked with college kids who hadn't ditched their baseball dreams when they hadn't been drafted. The initial results weren't promising.
Evan, it's a really interesting idea, but if we're going to do a promotion like that, you need to get more people to come to the game. How are we going to get some gate?
Another team told Evan,
we did have a banker pitch for us once, and he paid $20,000, and we let him pitch the first inning. But that was beyond my budget.
So enter, or rather re-enter, that website, Sidearm Nation. Evan contacted the website's founder, Jeff Freeborn. He suggested Evan focus on the Empire League in New York State, or maybe, if he didn't mind traveling, the Pecos League, which has teams in California and New Mexico, among other places.
And amazingly enough, when I called the commissioner of the Pecos League, Andrew Dunn, I ran my idea by him. We talked for a little while, and he said, you really want to play? I said, yeah, I do. He said, okay, we'll start working on it.
While Commissioner Dunn was working on it, Evan Katz was working at his day job as a budget guy with a public school system in Swampscott, Massachusetts. And a Pecos League team called the White Sands Pupfish was working on a wretched season in Alamogordo, New Mexico, during which they would never win consecutive games and finish dead last.
Well, I was in the superintendent's office going over the budget. And sure enough, My phone rings. I say, excuse me, to my boss, pull out the phone, and it says, Pecos League, Chris Stout. And that was him calling me to tell me I was going to be joining the team. And I was just, I mean, just like on TV, I was as excited as any of those draftees and pro players that get signed.
The signing is not perhaps quite as weird as it might seem. The Pupfish were about 1,000 games out of first place. In the low minors, players come and go all the time as young men and very young men discover that they aren't quite as good at baseball as they thought they were. What difference would the very temporary addition of one more player make? But how would the rest of the Pupfish take the news?
When we were in Alpine, Texas in a series, we get a call from our manager, and he was telling us that we were most likely going to have a guy come down.
That's Brandon Torres, a 23-year-old New Jersey guy who hit over 300 for the Pupfish this summer.
And then our manager goes, yeah, he's also like, you know, 60-something or something. Like, oh, man.
The risk was that these young guys, each of them hoping to play so well at the lowest level that he'll be noticed by somebody at a higher level and then at a level a little higher than that, would feel as if the organization was being treated like a joke, right? But that's not how Brandon Torres responded to the arrival of Evan Katz on July 28th.
You know, I just talked to him. He told me what he's trying to do, and this was his dream, and I respected it a lot. You know, and really just try to do everything possible to make him have fun those couple days and just enjoy the game of professional baseball.
It might be an exaggeration to say Evan Katz impressed his young teammates with his skills, but he's a guy who's in shape. He didn't embarrass himself when he pulled on a uniform.
He looked like an athlete.
That's 28-year-old Pupfish manager Chris Stout. Coming from him, looked like an athlete meant something. Before his first game as a Pupfish began, Evan, who'd been told he'd be a late-inning replacement in the field, asked Stout if he could warm up in the bullpen just to see what it was like. He must have looked okay. Stout changed the plan. Katz would pitch to the first batter in the seventh inning.
I felt great. Top of the seventh came, and I went out to the mound.
As Evan prepared to face his first batter in the sparsely populated bleacher, his sister Emily began streaming his pro debut live on Facebook.
The first pitch. That pitch was crushed. It was a fastball right over the middle of the plate. He crushed it down the right field line.
Foul ball here. No worries.
And this hitter was used to seeing guys throw in the 80s and low 90s, and he was getting my 60-mile-an-hour fastball. So he pulled it foul, and I said, great, there's a strike. That was fine with me. I got the ball over.
Next, Katz wasted a couple of pitches he didn't mean to waste.
Come on, Ev!
I went 3-1. Yeah, I think I threw him something high, and he swung and missed. 3-2.
Come on, Ev, you got it!
He had the guy 2 strikes, and everybody was hoping that he struck the guy out, you know, including me. You know, I was like, oh, man, I hope he strikes this guy out.
Brandon Torres' teammates in the dugout were so excited that they'd conspired to run out onto the field if Evan got that K. Cool, right? Okay, the tension rises. Then what?
Ball 4.
And the manager came running out to the mound and said, okay, Evan, forget it. You've had your experience. This is over.
Well, actually, I got a mulligan.
Katz faced a second batter, probably at least in part because the players, Brandon Torres among them, were urging the manager to leave him in. But Katz plunked the second batter he faced with his first delivery. His pitching line would read, one walk, one hit batter.
I went home that night and was discouraged, but it wasn't until the next morning that I realized the team was really behind me and they were supporting me. And this was something a little bigger than pitching and striking guys out.
On July 29th, in the final game of the season, Pupfish manager Chris Stout found another spot for his rookie. Evan Katz was sort of back where he started.
We put him in the outfield, and, you know, it's one of those things that we always say, you know, as soon as you put somebody new in the field, the ball always seems to find you. And it definitely found him, and the ball was hit pretty good.
Uh-oh. All right, he's hitting it, he's feeling it, he had no chance for it. He's getting the cutoff. There's no Mookie Betts out there.
So, big deal, right? The old guy chased a ball that was hit over his head, picked it up, and hit the cutoff man, who'd come about 50 yards out of the infield to take the throw. You could have done that, right? But what about when it came around to your turn to hit against somebody who could bring it at 90-plus miles an hour? Chris Stout saw Evans only at bat as the rookie's opportunity to earn some respect.
You know, anybody that can stand in on 90 is all right with me, because that's 90's pretty quick.
Good eye, Ev! Right, Evan, all right?
Here you go, Caps. Come on, Evan.
Pitch number one was a ball. It was high. And the second pitch was a strike.
Taken or?
Taken. I got ahead 3-1. Hitters count. And I had a very difficult decision to make. Which has more of a chance of happening? Him throwing two balls or me hitting one of his pitches? And I ended up leaning towards, I'm going to go for the walk. Because there was no way that I was going to hit this guy's fastball. He's got strike two. And the third pitch was really good. It was in the upper 80s on the outside corner. And called out.
You like to think that in Evans' cleats, you'd have gone down swinging, right? I mean, you get the chance, take your cuts. I like to think I'd have done that. But Chris Stout defends his hitter.
He had a strategy, and, you know, that's what he tried to accomplish. You know, I tell the guys all the time, you know, go up there and have a plan. And if that's his plan, then I'm glad he had a plan, because that means somebody out of the team listened to me that day. So that's good.
After the game, Evan thanked his teammates for their support.
What I said to the team was that I thought, and this is about getting at bats and getting a hit and pitching and getting the stats, but the experience was much more than that. It was sharing our passion of baseball and supporting each other and how they supported me and how that was something that I didn't expect.
In that locker room, after the last game of the season, there may have been some pupfish who were still puzzled about why this 61-year-old school administrator had shown up to play and why now he was shaking their hands and thanking them. But Brandon Torres understood.
For somebody to live their dream to play professional baseball, you know, everybody in that clubhouse and on that team also has the same dream. Why not share it with somebody, you know, who definitely really wanted to do it? And experience it, try to live it. You know, now he can say, hey, I play professional baseball. Not a lot of people can really say that.
Nope, not a lot of people can. But Evan Katz can, and at the end of the 2017 Pecos League season, he had the White Sands Pupfish box score to prove it. This week, I'd like to thank Shanster1966 for leaving the following review on iTunes. Every podcast I listen to introduces an excellent news story to research, writer to follow, or website to check out. They're not just rehashing the same stories you hear all week. You hear in-depth coverage of things you might not have heard much about. Do me a favor, please. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving your own review. They brighten our days, and they help other listeners to find our show. Baseball manager Casey Stengel had a particular way of talking. People called it Stengelese.
What's the difference if I am back in baseball if I keep busy? You can't take that goal with you unless you're... because it's so heavy, the money that I've made...
Stengel's life, as told by Casey and his wife Edna, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. This week, I'd like to thank Shanster1966 for leaving the following review on iTunes. Every podcast I listen to introduces an excellent news story to research, writer to follow, or website to check out. They're not just rehashing the same stories you hear all week. You hear in-depth coverage of things you might not have heard much about. Do me a favor, please. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving your own review. They brighten our days, and they help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. It was quite a week for sports news, so let's get right to it. I'm joined by ESPN's Don Vannata Jr. and The Ringer's Claire McNear. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
It's great to be back.
Don, start us off, please.
Around lunchtime on Wednesday, ESPN's veteran analyst Dick Vitale got word that Hall of Fame coach Rick Pitino was out at Louisville. Pitino was the first head coaching casualty of an unprecedented federal criminal investigation into the corrupt world of college basketball that indicted 10 men, including four assistant coaches, on charges of fraud, bribery, and money laundering. And boy, was Dick Vitale surprised.
I am upset
frustrated and disgusted to hear all what I'm hearing now. It's a shame. It's sleazy. It's no good. It's ugly. And it really just breaks my heart.
I love Dickie V, but this sounds awfully familiar.
I'm shocked, to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Other commentators and some fans sounded just as shocked that big-time college basketball might be a sleazy underground marketplace where coaches, agents, boosters, runners, financial advisors, sneaker companies, and other con artists exchange cash and other treats to recruit top amateur athletes. For at least 30 years now, it's been an open secret that college basketball is a swampland. And repeatedly over the years, anytime a scandal hit Louisville basketball, Rick Pitino expressed a similar kind of stunned surprise. This is a coach who survived not one but two sex scandals. The most recent one, 2 years ago, when a book reported that potential Louisville recruits reportedly were consorting with paid escorts. Pitino said he was stunned by the allegations and knew nothing about it. And earlier this week, he said it again about the allegation that $100,000 was paid through Adidas to one of his top recruits. Only this time, the shock and surprise didn't save Pitino's job. Surprise and shock were also all over my Twitter feed Monday night after I tweeted out a photo of Jerry Jones kneeling with the Cowboys in Arizona before the playing of the national anthem. Wow, the Twitter people said. Never thought Jerry Jones would kneel for anybody. Again, why is there so much surprise about something so obvious? The president of the United States had attacked NFL players who protest during the playing of the national anthem. Like the players, they had their own reasons for joining arms during the national anthem, or even, like Jerry Jones, taking a knee. Unity, yes. Supporting their players, sure. Pushing back on President Trump's attacks on the game, absolutely. But these protests and the attacks are also very bad for the NFL's business. And to be blunt about it, some of the owners were also motivated to lock arms with their players to try to protect the NFL's $14 billion in annual revenues and the billions of dollars in equity in their clubs.
As far as Jerry Jones goes, it's a genius move on his part, if not an altruistic one. And I don't really see how anyone can be surprised by this, because it's just a very clever, perhaps even evil, way of turning this protest into something else. You know, it's the anthem protest now. It's about unity, whatever that means. And I think the odds are good that in the next couple of weeks, if not this weekend, teams will agree sort of vaguely that the Constitution is important, that rights are important, and move on. And, you know, no one except maybe Donald Trump ever challenged that. So it's no surprise to me that Jerry Jones has kind of found a clever way out of this without actually addressing any of the issues.
It sounds to me as if you're suggesting that the original reason for the protest, which was police violence against black citizens, will be lost entirely in this yay, yay, let's all stand up for the flag kind of thing.
I think that's absolutely right. The Broncos put out a statement that was published on behalf of the players, they said, that went to great pains to say that the protest last weekend was basically about nothing. You know, they said this was absolutely not about the police. It was not about the country or patriotism or the military or the flag. They said it was just about unity, whatever that means.
Going back to Don's first point, is there any way that this basketball story can be construed as, hey, if we set up a system where the players are paid legally, we can cut out all these middlemen? Because that would be a good result to all of this, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, Bill. I agree. That's the problem. We have this underground system and all of these unscrupulous people profiting off of it, and it's been going on forever. And the fact that people are surprised, you know, the NCAA really just allowed this to happen. And it took a U.S. attorney in New York and the FBI with that subpoena power to finally criminalize it and bring it out in the open. And a lot more dominoes are going to fall. But if players were paid, we wouldn't have to have this corrupt system.
In any other week, our next story would probably be leading the sports news. Claire, this is up to you.
Well, there was huge news out of Boston University this week where researchers announced that for the first time ever, they've found a way of detecting the degenerative brain disease CTE in living patients. We don't know what exactly the test will involve or when it will be available, but this is just massive news for football players who will now have definitive proof of concussion-related trauma, perhaps before it's advanced to a more serious stage. That, in turn, has massive ramifications for the sport and for the NFL. How many players will keep going once they know the damage that's already been done? How many players will find out that they have CTE before they even get to the NFL and just decide not to go to the pros at all? How many parents are going to let their kids keep playing when they can see very, very explicitly, like they never could before, what's happening? I think this is the beginning of the end for football. What do you guys think?
It could be. I agree with Claire that it is a revolutionary advance. The problem with the CTE data and something that the NFL has been able to rely on is it's been a small sample and it's been a self-selecting sample. Now, as Claire points out, there will be thousands of people who are curious while they're still on this earth, while they're still playing football and drawing a paycheck for it, who can find out whether they have CTE symptoms. So it is a huge breakthrough and bad news for the NFL in the long term.
Claire, I think your questions are all good ones. Another question occurs to me, and that is, will there be players who say they'd prefer not to know, they'd prefer not to take the test, the way some people do with various other conditions and diseases now, when knowing doesn't mean that they can find a good way to deal with it? And that will be another interesting thing to find out when this test is actually available to people.
Absolutely. And even now you have players who say that they understand the risks and they're just going to keep playing anyway, that it's their choice to do that. And it absolutely is. I think an unpleasant question that's been in the background for many years, though, is just how many football players really understand the full risk of CTE. Mm-hmm. How many know how likely it is that they'll get this terrible disease? You read about so many players who say, oh, my God, I had no idea that I could get CTE from anything other than just major concussions. And I think with this test soon enough, we're going to have an answer to this.
All right. I'm going to take advantage of my opportunity here to strike a lighter note on this day of very serious topics. I want to salute the Minnesota Twins. This week, they became the first Major League Baseball team to qualify for the postseason immediately after a year in which they lost more than 100 games. Baseball, of course, has been around for more than 100 years. We can still look at each other from game to game and say, hey, that's never happened before. I've never seen that. To quote my old friend Tim Kirkchen, that's the beauty of baseball, something he always says. It's one of the beauties of baseball, at least. Would I be off base to say baseball leads the league in providing opportunities to see something you've never seen before in any given season, maybe even on any particular game night?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I'm biased, of course. But, I mean, you had the Dodgers this year who were on pace for their own historic season and most wins ever. They were absolutely on pace for it. And then they just completely fell apart in August for no clear reason. There were no injuries. You know, nothing could explain it. And, of course, now they're going to the postseason and may do very well there. But they almost had their own historic August in terms of just losses. So it's just amazing that we can see all of that in a single season.
What I'm really struck by with what's happened with the Twins going from 100 losses to the playoffs, it strikes a little bit like the NFL and parity, the old Pete Rozelle parity rule that, you know, if you have four or five wins or even three wins in an NFL season, the system is designed to give the fans of that particular losing team a chance the next year. And we never see that in baseball, as you pointed out. It's pretty extraordinary. So maybe parity is coming to baseball after all.
For reasons that we may not ever be able to understand. But right. What fun to be able to stick up for the former national pastime in this season of discontent for football especially. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been ESPN's Don Vannata Jr. and The Ringer's Claire McNear. Thank you, both of you, very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much for having me.
Casey Stengel, who died in 1975 at the age of 85, had a long career in baseball as a player and manager. But he's perhaps most remembered for his invention of Stengelese, a language he spoke fluently, often in bursts.
What's the difference if I am back in baseball if I keep busy? You can't take that goal with you unless you're... Because it's so heavy, the money that I've made, that if I go out and go on the water and I'd want to take that... It's a wreck, and I'd want to take that goal with me. You can't take that goal with you, but... People say you can, because I know a man that did it. He had it around his belt, and what did he do? He went overboard, and it was so heavy, the gold sunk. So there's a man who took the gold with him. So what good is it if you're, you know, if you're shipwrecked and you're under the water?
Stengel played in the majors for five different teams between 1912 and 1925. Once he caught a sparrow in his hat, put the hat back on his head, and then when it was his turn to come to the plate, he tipped his hat and let the sparrow fly away. A good time was had by all. When his playing days ended, he managed in the minors and the majors. Like lots of managers, when he had good players, he won, and when he didn't, he lost. Up against the unhappy fact that he sometimes couldn't remember the names of his players when he managed the Mets in their early years, who could? Casey shrugged and said, "Them are all good boys." He also said, "The Mets is like the WPA. We give everyone a job." His Stengelese wasn't limited to baseball. We don't have recordings of every burst of it, but consider, for example, Casey's recollection, recreated here by actor Mike Lovell, regarding his courtship of Edna Mae Lawson, with whom Stengel, still a player, when they met, would share his life for 51 years.
Edna had this Jewish doctor from Brooklyn, and I swept her off her feet, so the doctor never married anybody, and went on to do some splendid operations while he was waiting for me and Edna to split up. But he's still waiting. And I don't know how good his operations are anymore. And why would you go to him if he couldn't concentrate on his work?
Dr. Darrell, whom I'd come east to see and saw very little of, warned me, "You'd better forget about that ball player. He's not good enough for you." But I'm afraid it was the doctor I forgot about.
Our Edna is played by actor Amanda Balaguer. As manager of the Boston Bees in the late 30s and early 40s, Casey presided over more losses than wins, and attendance was awful.
People often ask me if this affected his personality. Did he snap at the dog, glower at the toaster, snarl at his wife? No, never. Casey would start talking baseball the minute we left Braves Field, and he'd gab nonstop until we reached our hotel.
It was during those days that Casey cut one of his pitchers, sending him to the minor league team in Hartford for lack of courage under pressure. The pitcher was Warren Spahn. After serving in the military for 3 years, he'd win 363 major league games.
Yes, I said no guts to the kid who wound up being a war hero and one of the best pitchers anybody ever saw. You can't say I don't miss him when I miss him.
After Boston, Casey and Edna headed for the minors. Eventually, Stengel found himself managing the Oakland Oaks to a Pacific Coast League title.
It was the biggest thing that had happened in that city since the Bay Bridge was built. Oakland went wild. His fame spread, his antics became legend. Casey was a little too famous for the Coast League to keep to itself any longer.
Edna was right. Next stop, Yankee Stadium. Moving to the biggest of the big-time teams didn't alter Casey's obsession with the game. If anything, that obsession grew, as Edna discovered when they were supposed to be on a vacation in Puerto Rico in 1952.
The first night, he can't go to sleep. Not too far off, there is a familiar muffled roar.
"Sounds like a baseball game,"
Casey says, peeping over the covers. "It's probably some sort of festival," I said. "Now turn over and get some rest." Well, 3 hours later, he's back in the room and telling me about a pitcher and a shortstop he saw. That was the end of our baseball sabbatical.
From 1949 through 1960, Casey presided over 7 World Series wins by the Yankees. It was no surprise when people started honoring him. In Glendale, California, his hometown, they dedicated Stengel Field.
"I've been thrown out of a lot of baseball parks, but this is the first one named after me."
Also by then, Casey had seen more than a few innovations in the game. 1955 brought in batting helmets.
"If we'd had them when I was playing, John McGraw would have insisted that we go up to the plate and get hit on the head."
Throughout the days of celebrity in New York, Edna contributed to the family legend. At a publicity event in Milwaukee before the World Series in 1957, though she was wearing a dress and heels, Edna agreed to try to milk a cow. She had no success.
"Someone milked this cow before I did."
In 1958, Casey was asked to educate a committee of the U.S. Senate regarding baseball's reserve clause. Apropos of nothing, he took advantage of the big stage to review his progress in baseball, which had not been without missteps.
I had many years I was not so successful as a ballplayer, as it is a game of skill. And then I was no doubt discharged by baseball, in which I had to go back to the minor leagues as a manager. And after being in the minor leagues as a manager, I became a major league manager in several cities and was discharged. We call it discharge because there was no question I had to leave.
By 1960, which would be Stengel's final season with the Yankees, he was beginning to feel his age, which was 70. He took some time away from the team and checked into the hospital for a physical. When he rejoined the Yankees, he claimed the news was mostly encouraging.
I'll tell you something. They examined all my organs. Some of them are quite remarkable. Others are not so good. A lot of museums are bidding for them.
Shortly thereafter, he was discharged by the Yankees, which meant there was no question that he had to leave, though he would return to New York in 1962 to manage the Mets to four last-place finishes. Somehow he lived for another decade after that debacle. The words on a plaque at the site where Casey and Edna are buried suggest that he had no trouble shrugging off the losses.
There comes a time in every man's life, and I've had plenty of them.
Thanks to Marty Appel, who wrote the book that provided me with a lot of what Casey and Edna said. It's titled Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. Chess International Master Dorsa Derek Shani is smart, very smart.
Are you saying you could read at the age of two?
No, I could read when I was 1.5. But I finished first grade when I was 2.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, the new politics and history podcast that asks, what is happening? And has it happened before?
Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with decades of experience in Washington. He's a great writer, asks great questions, and always keeps us laughing.
Oh, Heather, stop, stop. Okay, so Heather is not just a noted historian, but she's different. Heather lives in present tense, but also carries history right up with her to this moment.
Every week with our guests, we try and make sense of what's going on. We ask, is this completely unprecedented? Should we panic?
People are freaking out, both Democrats and Republicans. We want you to be able to take a deep breath and exhale. And by the end of the podcast, you will carry on.
Join us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Freak Out and Carry On.
I'm Bill Littlefield. It's a very bad idea to try to paddle a canoe from Winnipeg to the mouth of the Amazon River. Next week on Only a Game, we'll meet some crazy souls who tried it anyway. But right now, it's time for my conversation about the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Running afoul of the NCAA comes with a territory if you're a big-time college basketball coach, cost of doing business. But running afoul of the FBI, not so much. However, this week we learned that multiple college coaches have allegedly done that. Who are they, and what do you think the consequences are going to be?
Well, one consequence is Rick Pitino doesn't have a job anymore at the University of Louisville. It's a farce, Bill. This whole thing is a waste of taxpayers' time. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. The Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office and the New York Office of the FBI desperately need a win, and they found a very big fish in a very small barrel. And just when you thought it couldn't get any clearer, the House of Representatives is getting involved.
They'll clean it up.
Yeah, absolutely. We can count on that. I mean, the idea that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been turned into the enforcement arm of the NCAA is hilariously wrong. And by the way, this is the best thing that ever happened in the NCAA. That organization was on the ropes for 3 years. Now, all of a sudden, it can stand up as the people. See, if we actually pay these guys, this is the kind of corruption that will enter our sports.
Oh, that's the take.
I guarantee you that you will hear that sooner or later.
Okay.
I hope this whole investigation falls apart like an overcooked turkey. I really do.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell met with owners and players on Tuesday in order to discuss issues surrounding the kneeling during the anthem. We have been, and I think justifiably, we have been hard on Goodell for a long time, Charlie. Has his handling of this issue cast him in any more favorable light?
Well, I mean, he has not bungled this into a national disaster yet, so we give him credit for that.
Because the president beat him to it.
Exactly right.
DirecTV has offered to refund the money customers spent on their Sunday ticket package if they're angry about players kneeling. I wonder how many people are just going to say, I wish I hadn't spent that money, and I'm angry. Give me my money
back. I won't believe that there's any kind of national reaction to this until I start hearing from bookies that people are refusing to bet on the NFL because they're angry about the anthem protests. That is when I will know this is a serious backlash.
Baltimore Ravens head coach John Harbaugh has said that he is not interested in playing in London anymore. Tell me why that is. I like London very much. And also tell me whether the coach can expect an angry call from the commissioner on this.
Oh, I don't know. You know, going over there for the purposes of falling behind the Jacksonville Jaguars 37-0.
It didn't work out.
Well, I mean, that would cause you to avoid an entire country for a while.
He's blaming London for that?
He's blaming the trip and, you know, we have to fly.
They both had to go.
Blah, blah, blah. I understand. And Jacksonville is still not a team you should fall behind 37-0 to.
The WNBA Finals began about as dramatically as possible. In Game 1, the Los Angeles Sparks beat the Minnesota Lynx by a point, 85-84. And in Game 2, the Lynx beat the Sparks by 2 points, 70-68. I'm going to be wondering if the game ending this, probably Game 5, goes into quadruple overtime.
That would be fair. I mean, these are two really good games. And, of course, it began also with a protest from the two teams.
Right.
This is exciting basketball. This is very high-level basketball, and it's being played very well between two teams. You can't shine a flashlight between these two teams in terms of trying to figure out which one is best. So, yeah, I hope the ratings pick up, and I hope people give this a real chance.
The NHL season begins on Thursday.
Yeah!
I'm sure that you were on hand for the traditional parade of the Zambonis.
I was. It was wonderful. And this year, Bill, it went down the strip in Las Vegas.
Yes, it did. And we're going to talk about that. At the risk of overdoing the only game tradition that we seem to have established, mentioning the Vegas Golden Knights as often as possible, they are the only NHL team ever to have embedded the names of their season ticket holders in the ice at the arena. I got to wonder if the release of that news has inspired thousands more to sign up for season tickets.
This is a great idea. By the way, I do not often give our listeners advice. Follow the Golden Knights on Twitter. They have a great Twitter account. I don't know who's doing it, but they do live tweeting during the games. And part of the persona of the Twitter account is that the person is watching hockey for the first or second time.
Oh, I love it.
It has tweets like, they're up 2-0. Should we be worried? I am following the Golden Knights. I don't care. Who knows it? My lifelong loyalty to Les Habitants aside, the Vegas Golden Knights are now my mascot team in the NHL.
The Yankees, victims earlier this season of cheating on the part of the Boston Red Sox, were victimized again this week. Who done them wrong this time?
A fan, apparently, was yelling where the catcher was setting up, therefore giving away the location of the pitches to Gary Sanchez when he was batting.
And
yelling in Spanish. In Espanol, yes. And he was removed from the ballpark. I hesitate to tell the story because it involves somebody who's very close to me. But I was at a fencing tournament one time, and a fencer was on the wrong side of a referee's call and used a phrase in Russian that his coach used when his coach got mad and did not realize that the referee was Russian.
Oops.
And, oh, jeez, this is the same thing. Was this guy connected to Gary Sanchez? Is there a Gary Sanchez conspiracy at work out there? Who knows?
I think the House will look into this quite soon.
I think the House of Representatives is on the case right now.
And finally, Charlie, there's a new Coastal Plain League team in Macon, Georgia, and their nickname is the Macon Bacon. Brilliant minor league marketing plan or tasteless gambit designed to alienate vegetarians?
Oh, I certainly hope it's the latter I don't know about alienate vegetarians. I think it certainly is a tasteless gambit, and I'm all in favor of it.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On February 19th of this year, Dorsa Derek Shani found herself at the center of controversy. She hadn't seen it coming. Dorsa is a chess international master. That's just one step below grandmaster. Back in 2016, she became just the second Iranian woman in history to earn that title. But we're going to begin our story a few years earlier than that. Okay, a lot of years earlier, in 2000. Dorsa was two and appearing on a children's television show. Reporter Mike Klein has our story.
In the grainy video, Dorsa Derek Shani wears a red velvet dress with puffy sleeves and dark tights. She's tightly clutching a stuffed puppy, so the interviewer holds the microphone for her. Dorsa breaks into song with the poise of a seasoned performer, and the studio audience applauds. The camera cuts to the audience. Most of the girls are sitting in the back. Many are wearing headscarves. Dorsa's head is uncovered. Dorsa was born in Tehran in 1998, and this is just one of many times she appeared on Iranian TV. She reads a story from a children's book. It's not the broken staccato of many early readers.
My mom used to make up stories every day just to teach me one word. And then she would write that word down on a card and show it to me, and I would learn that word. So I finished first grade when I was 2 years old.
In the United States, first grade would be finished when you're six or seven, and most first graders can basically read. Are you saying you could read at the age of two?
No, I could read when I was one and a half. But I finished first grade when I was two.
Dorsa's television career as a child prodigy was never going to last forever, but it ended abruptly when she was six.
They made me wear a scarf against my will, and I thought that that was pretty stupid because, well, I'm six. Why would I need to wear a scarf? So I ruined the live TV and I ran out. Then they told me that whenever I change my mind, I can go back. I never did, so I never went back for the TV. I finished fourth grade when I was four and a half. Math, science, everything. But the government never had anybody else who managed to finish those grades early, so there was no protocol. So I had to go to first grade when I already finished fourth grade. So my parents tried to fill my time with other things like music, swimming, ballet, gymnastics, painting.
Right next door to her painting class was a chess class. Dorsa decided to join. Her younger brother came along too, milk bottle in hand. Was chess different than most of the other things you were learning because it was so difficult?
Yeah, chess is really different because you're actually playing with a live human being. But, I mean, even in swimming, you're doing your skills, but it's not really a fight. Or in studying, the more you study, the more it pays off. In chess, it's not like that. I mean, you can't be 100% ready and sure that you play good when you go to a tournament.
Dorsa's first big success came in the Iranian National Youth Under 8 tournament.
It was a big surprise for everyone because they were players who already had private coaches and they came to win. I came out of nowhere and I won the tournament. I remember that everybody else was wearing scarf, even under 8, but I wore a princess dress and a tiara, and it was really cute. I didn't really have a female chess role model, and even if I wanted to, there were no Iranians to look into and be like, oh, I want to be like this girl.
Dorsa went on to win three straight gold medals at the 2012, 2013, and 2014 Asian Junior Championships. In the numerical chess rating lists, Dorsa was at the top for all girls in Asia. When you played in these tournaments, did you wear a headscarf, and when did you choose to either do so or not do so?
Well, actually in Iran, there is no rule that when the girl is 8 or 10, she has to wear a scarf. So between 10 until 12, the girls start to want to wear because everybody else is wearing. But, well, I try to delay it as much as possible. So I wasn't wearing a scarf up until I was 12. And when I entered under 14, I I decided that, okay, it's time that I start wearing a scarf.
Dorsa says the head of the Iranian Chess Federation, Mehrdad Pahlavinzadeh, often saw her at tournaments without a headscarf.
I remember actually he told me and everybody else that how you wear the hijab doesn't matter, just don't get photographed.
I first met Dorsa at the Chess Olympiad in September 2016. She was attending as a journalist, not a player. The tournament was in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, a country that is 98% Muslim. She didn't wear a headscarf at the tournament or on the street. I've never seen her wear one. Dorsa no longer had much desire to compete for her country. She explains the decision this way.
If they're actually giving services to me, like coach, training, tournaments, money, anything, then I would feel responsible to do as I'm told. I chose not to use government money, so the rules didn't apply to me.
How did you first find out that something had happened?
How did I find out? That's very funny. So I was traveling and I didn't have internet connection. When I connected to Wi-Fi at first, I started getting about 3 requests per second on Instagram. And I was like, okay, this is crazy. So something must have happened. But I didn't know what, so I just blocked Instagram notification. And I slept, and the next day when I woke up, all of my high school friends asked me, what did you do? Are you okay? Did they jail you? I was like, wait, what's going on? So they told me that they saw on newspaper that my federation banned me. And my brother and I, actually, both of us. It was just very out of the blue, and without any warning, without anything.
Dorsa and her brother, Borna, played an international tournament in late January and early February in Gibraltar. A computer decides the matchups, and in the opening round, 14-year-old Borna was paired with Grandmaster Alexander Huzman. Borna played the game, but there was one problem. Huzman represents Israel, a fact that the pairing sheet didn't show. Tournament organizers usually manually manipulate the pairings to avoid these matchups, but for this one, the organizers apparently forgot. A few weeks after the tournament ended, Mehrdad Pahlavinzadeh announced that Borna was banned from both playing for Iran and entering tournaments inside Iran. In the same press conference, he also banned Dorsa for not wearing a headscarf.
I didn't have any problems for myself because I was not living in the country. But somehow, I felt that it was very unfair and cruel. They should not assume that the 14-year-old would know what's the right thing to do.
Dorsa has a theory. She believes the action against her and her brother was a tactic to divert from other news. The announcement came in the middle of the Women's World Chess Championship, which was being held in Tehran. Several notable players, including the reigning U.S. women's champion, boycotted the event because players were required to wear a headscarf. All 3 Iranian women competing had just been eliminated in the opening round. The federation was also on shaky financial ground with FIDE, the international governing body of chess.
So, middle of all this, they needed another distraction, and somebody tipped off the reporters to especially ask about my brother and I, which worked perfectly. Nobody spoke about how the other players got knocked out. Everybody started talking about us.
I attempted to contact Mehrdad Pahlavinzadeh, the head of the Iranian Chess Federation, for comment, but he hasn't responded. Dorsa doesn't give interviews to Iranian media. She no longer trusts that her words won't be used out of context. She was already living in Spain by the time she was banned. Shortly thereafter, her brother began attending school in England. Her parents stayed behind in Iran.
My family didn't want to become a refugee or anything. I mean, there was a time that I was considering to offer it to my brother, but then a 14-year-old becoming a refugee, that's not even sad. It's kind of all of the negative emotions all together. So fortunately, we never actually had to consider it seriously. His student visa came earlier than it was expected, and he moved.
Dorsa had mixed results playing in tournaments this spring all over Europe. This July, she moved to the U.S. after being accepted to the chess team at St. Louis University. She said there were no problems when she landed in New York and cleared immigration.
I'm hoping to become a dentist. I'm looking forward to finally having a stable trainer and a team. And I really wish to become grandmaster.
That's chess international master Dorsa Derakhshani speaking with reporter Mike Klein. Earlier this month, Dorsa officially changed federations. She now represents the United States at chess tournaments. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Brian Bouchard. Our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. Our final word comes from Dorsa Derakhshani, who isn't worried about the chess federation she's left behind.
Well, I think chess in Iran will be fine without me. They're not going to really miss me.
Their loss, and a gain for the U.S. Welcome. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.